All righty, welcome back to the Week in Review. I'm Bob Slade, along with Judge Bob Pickett and the cut man, Charles W. Ettridge III. The undercover brother, flamethrowing little rascal Peter Noel, is playing hooky.
Is off today.
He's playing hooky from Woik. Mm. Yeah, you hear that, Waldo?
Buckwheat is off.
Buckwheat is off. Anyway, we have some guests in the studio, Judge Pickett.
No doubt about it, Bob. Thank you very much. You know, from time to time, we like to talk about books and the race issues important to our community. And we're delighted to have two guests in studio, Bob. Amy Neustein, who's apparently been on
she's been on the show before. Back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, back in the day.
With Milton McLean Dennis.
That's right.
Highlighted what's going on.
That's right. And Michael Lesher, who is an attorney. They've written a book called From Madness to Mutiny, and it's Why Mothers Are Running from the Family Courts and What Can Be Done About It. Apparently, there's a crisis going on all across the country, and specifically in New York State, in which mothers are losing custody of their children for a whole host of reasons. Some of it, a lot of it, Amy and Michael contend, bogus. Welcome to the show, Amy and Michael. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Michael, we'll start with you, because Amy has some personal experience, and we'll get into her story. But tell us about the book and your proposition. Exactly what are you trying to convey with this book to the public?
We see this problem really as today's emerging civil rights crisis. We're talking about an area that has not really been recognized as a civil rights problem before, and it's becoming a massive one. More and more people are ending up in the family courts. More and more people are making abuse allegations against spouses and ex-spouses. And when they do, they end up in a system having absolutely no idea what to expect in that system. They don't know that mental health theories that are not legally acceptable can nevertheless be used against them. Mm-hmm. They don't know that there can be communications between the judge and other people involved in the case off the record, which can control the result without their being aware of it. But these things will happen. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they've made an accusation in good faith, the fact that there's no evidence that they've abused or neglected a child, doesn't necessarily matter. They can end up losing the children. They can end up losing visitation rights.
Mm-hmm. On just bogus allegations, just the court system. I mean, your theory is that the court system and all of the people who feed off of the court system are in some way creating this result.
That's right. This is a system that really created itself. It's grown up over time in order to perform a very specialized function, and very specialized institutions have become part of it. You have law guardians who are appointed to represent children. It's a sort of special species of legal representative. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be representing the best interest of the child. You've got a sort of mental health subspecialty, people who get involved in evaluating sex abuse allegations. And what happens is these, and you have, of course, Child Protective Services agencies. These agencies and professionals and lawyers deal with each other more than they deal with anybody else. Mm-hmm. And they've created a system that largely has its own rules, mm-hmm. rules that to the outsider will look like madness.
That's right.
Well, give us an example of some of these crazy rules.
Well, you know, you would think it's self-evident that if a person is accused of abusing a child, that person has the benefit of the doubt. That person is innocent until proved guilty, and that is, in fact, the way the system more or less works. It should also go without saying that if you've made a good faith allegation that your partner or spouse abused the child, you're entitled to the same consideration. You're also innocent until proved guilty. The fact that the accusation turns out not to be provable shouldn't be proof that you're an unfit parent. As a practical matter, though, because of some of the theories hanging around family courts, like parental alienation syndrome or Munchausen syndrome by proxy, the mere fact that you believe that abuse may have happened and you've got some reasonable basis for believing it but can't prove it can be enough to cause you to lose custody.
Right. In other words, they turn they turn your allegations around on you.
That's right.
And suggest that you are indeed the unfit parent for even bringing the charges
and
so forth. That's
right. And strangest of all is that the very things that might tend to make your accusation seem more believable and more credible are the things that are used against you to prove that there's something more wrong with you.
Mm.
If the child is particularly upset, if the child shows a fear or aversion to the accused parent, that, according to the father of parental alienation syndrome, Richard Gardner, is proof that the accusation must be false. Mm. You must be manufacturing it to turn the child against him. If you yourself are very upset about the charge, that is evidence that it could be fabricated.
How much of this is impacting on the African-American community?
I mean,
do you see a lot of this happening in the with the African-American mothers who raise these kinds of abuse issues?
We do. We see it all across the demographic spectrum, but we do see it very much affecting the African-American community.
What percentage, which, if I may?
I don't know if I could tell you a percentage. Maybe Amy would be
all right, Amy, let's bring you into the discussion, Amy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I spoke on this issue for the African-American community back in 1991 when I was a guest speaker at the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus up in Albany. I participated in Women in Leadership and Empowerment, which was a workshop that was part of the caucus. And I will never forget that after I gave my address at the caucus, one of the assembly persons approached me afterwards, and she asked for my assistance in putting together a hearing. Well, we put together that hearing several months later, and the New York Post came down along with other papers, and there was a very compelling case where an African-American mother who had worked for Goldman Sachs had testified how her child was stripped from her in retaliation for making a good faith report of abuse. The case made it into the newspapers in New York. The mother got up and said she described so poignantly the humiliation that she was exposed to by the social services system. She had to roll up her sleeves to show that she had no needle marks in her arms because the social worker said to her, if the judge stripped you of custody, you must be a drug abuser. The woman got up before a packed room at 270 Broadway, where the legislative building offices used to be. Now they're at 250. And she said, I'm not on public assistance. I am an educated woman. I am responsible. I have no history of neglect, but the system has turned against me. Mm. It was a terrible, terrible case. But unfortunately, it's not an anomaly. Many years ago, I offered to testify in the Bronx Family Court for an African-American mother whose child was alleged to have been sexually abused. It was a three-year-old girl. According to the psychologist I had spoken to and the reports I read, the little girl was already supposedly developing a multiple personality as a way of dissociating. In order to cope with the abuse, she went into a different personality so that she didn't have to face the trauma to her body. I came to court. I got on the witness stand. I was thrown off. Wasn't allowed to testify. I was just started to talk about my credentials when the law guardian made an objection to my testifying without giving grounds, and the judge simply acquiesced to the law guardian. I was thrown out of the courtroom, and I waited outside for this mother rather than leaving because I wanted to give her moral support. And I was reading a newspaper, and one of the bailiffs came over to me in the Bronx Family Court, and he threatened me with handcuffs. Mm. This is the environment.
This is the madness that you're talking
about,
right?
Yes, yes, yes. It's a mad environment. It's oppressive. It's retaliatory. It's punitive. And it is a groundswell.
But does it affect just mothers only, or are we talking about both fathers and mothers?
Well, we looked at mothers for this reason. It is affecting fathers. There's no question about it. And I would say in the African-American community, there is a deliberate attempt to remove fathers from the lives of the children. You have good fathers that want to care for the children and be involved with visitation and do support the children. And the cruelties of the court is such that they have to find one party to assassinate and to humiliate and reproach. So sometimes they'll go after the father, sometimes they'll go after the mother. However, sexual abuse is usually committed by men as opposed to women. There are female abuses, but it is a male-dominated crime. So the one who's going to raise an issue about sexual abuse is the mother, because she is the one not committing the abuse. She is the non-offending parent.
Right.
So when the mother is the non-offending parent, the court has to turn its venom and its anger on her. They crucify the mother by using, as my co-writer Michael Lesher mentioned a moment ago, by using a suspect mental health theories that make the mother the problem. And as Michael Lesher, as an attorney, has often mentioned to me during this project, that these mental health theories stand in lieu of proving malice. In other words, in any other kind of litigation, you have to prove malice. Right. But if you take malice out of the equation and you substitute it with mental illness, as soon as you can say the mother's mentally ill because you get a quack to say so, right, then malice is out the window. And all you have to do is say she's mentally ill. Aha, uh-huh, she's guilty.
And therefore she loses her child or children. Michael, let's bring you back in. What's the resolution? How do we resolve these problems in the court, in the family court system, and make them more sane as opposed to mad?
There are a lot of things that can be done. We make a number of recommendations in the book. I still think probably first and foremost, and this is a reform that everybody can understand, the whole system needs to rethink one of its most basic assumptions, which is the rule of confidentiality, the rule that essentially seals these proceedings and their records from public review. The theory behind this, of course, is that it protects the child, it protects the innocent. Our experience is that it doesn't do that at all. It protects the guilty, it protects the bad judges, it protects the bad law guardians, it protects the people who are not doing their jobs. Just to take one example, and we mention this in the book, there's a woman, a young woman in California, who had a case years ago before a family court. She was placed in her father's custody with a law guardian supporting this and a therapist supporting it, even though she was had accused the father of abuse. Eventually, the father ends up being convicted criminally of having abused her, and she then brings a suit against the law guardian. Well, that suit was dismissed, and it was dismissed because the courts are so far-holding that law guardians are immune from suit, even by their former clients, under the theory of quasi-judicial immunity. So you have two things here. Number one, who's accountable? Right. How are these people involved in the system accountable? That has to be rethought. And who the heck knows about proceedings like this? Mm. Because the public can't see the records.
But let me ask you this question. In terms of the book, though, let me just ask this question. Yeah, in terms of the book, if one of our listeners out there were to buy this book, would it be helpful for them to have a full understanding of what they're going to be confronted with as they sort of navigate themselves through the family court system?
Absolutely. From Madness to Mutiny serves many functions. First of all, the person reading the book will learn if they are involved in the system or have a dear friend or family member who is so involved, that they'll learn they're not alone. That's number one, that the madness that they are experiencing or their relatives are experiencing is not in their own mind, but it's a reality. That's the first thing. The second thing the book, From Madness to Mutiny, will accomplishes is it's an educational tool. And it serves for a mother to bring to her counsel, to show her counsel, these are the types of pitfalls and things to be concerned about: hostile law guardians, tendentious mental health theories, hostile child protective service agencies that bring spurious charges. And the book also has a whole section on reform. Now, citizens in the African American community who are concerned about reforming the courts should pay attention to the fact that the minority leader of the Senate, Senator David Patterson, who I acknowledge in the book, in the beginning of the book, and who is mentioned in several critical places in the book, was one of the first legislators to embark on an examination of the problems in the family court system. If the public out there reads From Madness to Mutiny, they should urge their legislators to hold hearings, to open up the problem, and to make its mark on history.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a cynic. To me, this is the Dred Scott decision. To me, this is nothing more than the enrichment of a group of people, a class, that is, in effect, perpetuating some kind of childhood slavery, where children are removed from their parents the same way on breeding farms in the South, parents were separated from their children. If you take away the profiteering element of it, the people being paid, the lawyers, the guardians, the agencies that hire people to work there and then increase their budgets, we wouldn't even be having this, because obviously the issue is not the issue that it's purported to be. And once again, to me, this is just another way that black elected officials are perpetuating and participating in the genocide of their own people because they don't put a stop to it.
Well, the book is called From Madness to Mutiny, Why Mothers Are Running from the Family Courts and What Can Be Done About It. It's a good read, a good book for those of you out there who are having problems or thinking about going into the family court system. This is a must read. There's a book signing coming up, right, Michael and Amy?
That's correct.
Tell us where, Michael.
At Clifton Commons, the Barnes & Noble there in Clifton, New Jersey, on June 23rd, I think 7:30. Is that right?
That's correct. I also want to say, excuse me, that anyone interested in the book From Madness to Mutiny, call your local Barnes & Noble, ask them to order the book. If they don't have it, just give them the title From Madness to Mutiny. The book has been selling very well. Before it was even published, there were 600 pre-orders. There's a great need for this book.
You're good, Amy. You're good.
Get that sale in there, Amy Neustein.
she's very good. The book is called From Madness to Mutiny, Amy Neustein and Michael Lesher. We do appreciate it. And again, we recommend the book. The book is a good read, especially for those of you about to venture into the family court system.
All right. We'll take a break. Come right back with our remaining moments. You're listening to The Week in Review.